You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, July 5th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Peter Shamshiri, co-host of the 5-4 podcast and contributor to the Balls and Strikes column put out by Demand Justice. Also on the program today, six dead, at least 30 injured. Highland Park, Illinois, 4th of July parade shooting. Meanwhile, U.S. announces another $820 million in military aid to Ukraine, bringing the total of military aid to Ukraine to $6.9 billion since the Russia invasion. Biden administration proposes up to 10 oil and gas lease sales in the Gulf of Mexico and Alaska over the next 5 years, reversing a campaign pledge. Meanwhile, in Akron, Ohio, 25-year-old Jalen Walker, an unarmed black man, shot in a hail of 60 bullets over a traffic stop. NATO nations signed protocols for Sweden and Finland to enter into that alliance. Omicron BA5 variant now set to become the dominant one in the U.S. as studies show reinfection is easy and increases your chances of long COVID. And in today's Republican victory file, 10-year-old girl, rape victim in Ohio, forced to travel to Indiana for an abortion. Speaking of Indiana, that 10-year-old rape victim gets there. They'll be greeted by a new Indiana law that now requires no permit to carry a handgun. Democrats congeal around a consultant class failed strategy for 2022 midterms. You'll be happy to know. And lastly, Brittany Griner, WNBA star, on trial in Russia, sends a handwritten plea to President Biden. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Hope you had a happy 4th of July weekend, as there's much that can be said by that. Joining me, as always, Emma Vigeland. I don't know about you, Emma, but my 4th of July was I've never been a big 4th of July fan. I'm not going to lie to people. The fireworks have been, from a very young age, just seemed creepy to me that we are watching essentially the closest replica we can have to a city being bombed. And so many times on 4th of July, I've watched those and wondered, like, oh, I wonder if this is what it's like in the country that we're bombing now today. Or I remember at one point thinking about that, that must be what it feels like to be in Lebanon.
It's great for the veterans here in the United States to hear all that, plus the dogs, too. I mean, honestly, it's just I'm very anti-firework, as we share that.
L.A. apparently was doing a laser light show to avoid fires, and I'm a little okay with
that. They're doing drones now. They had drones in the shape of the Starship Enterprise, which was kind of cool.
That's
some
cool.
Place I saw.
Wow, that is a good idea.
Yeah,
and of course, then they can be deployed to spy on you or to
track
deliver
your
Amazon package.
That too, just like such obvious excess when we participate in fireworks.
The
anti-fireworks show,
and of course. In addition to the past week and a half of Supreme Court rulings, which have fundamentally will fundamentally alter this country and are a harbinger to fundamental changes going forward. We'll be talking to Peter Shamshiri about that in just a bit. Of course, first thing in the morning, or I should say first thing in the morning, I guess, in terms of Central Time, but by midday on the East Coast, first thing in the morning on the West Coast, I guess, we got report of a shooter on standing on a building, a low-rise building, overlooking a parade in Highland Park, Illinois, opening up firing with a high-powered semi-automatic weapon. You can hear, I'm sure you've heard the videos of, and I want to play clip number, the father, the number, and firing on parade watchers. Apparently, this is before the parade actually reached the area in which the shooter was firing and killing six people, at least 30 injured. And they have apprehended someone they believe is a they call person of interest at this point. 22-year-old
Bobby Cremo,
white man, Bobby Cremo. We don't know too much about that person, and we don't want to get out ahead of things. There's some social media suggesting that maybe he's attended Trump rallies, but we just don't know. In terms of like giving any insight into the motivations, but really, the point is, and as far as we know, the gun was purchased legally. That was what the mayor of Highland Park said. The mayor also was aware of this, person of interest because his father ran against her in the mayoral race. But the really, main takeaway from this is, there is no safe place when you inundate a society with guns. This is inevitable. And the more guns, the more inevitability of this. And the less restrictions, the more inevitability of this. So I don't know. Folks can have an option. They can not. And they cannot take any action, or they can get used to stories like this of a father protecting his child at that parade.
He reloaded, and then that's when I grabbed my son, and I ran around the corner, and I put him in a dumpster, a garbage dumpster, and I asked some people to stay there with him because I had to go back to find the rest of my family. And when I went back, there was people shot on the ground. There was a little boy that was being carried away. Probably 6 to 8 years old. And that was the worst part of all of this, because being a father and, hiding your children and seeing a little boy carried away, I can't imagine that what that family's going through right now.
It doesn't get more horrific than that. I mean, all of those people who attended that parade are going to be forever scarred by this. Obviously, some even more damaged than others. And this is just, this is the society we've decided to live in for the, I guess, the value it provides for gun manufacturers.
I mean, you listen to that gun rung out, and it sounds like a jackhammer. Just repeatedly going boom, 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 boom. And you think, like, this is freedom? This is what it's like to be free, is that some kid can just go buy one of these things that can just slaughter 20 people in a go. I mean, that's not how many people died, but that's more than how many people got injured.
I mean, what we experienced, though, was arguably the most American 4th of July in my lifetime. On the heels of Roe being overturned and Christian fundamentalists wielding their power in this country, there was a mass shooting on that very day. And it's not to trivialize it in any way. It's incredibly sad, but it's also to be expected based on the power that the right has seized in this country on the gun front, and then of course on the abortion front as well.
horrible, and we will talk about that ruling with Peter Shamsheri in a moment. First, just a quick correction from the other day. We played a video footage of a Russian strike on a shopping mall in Ukraine. And it has been suggested to me, and I have not been able to fully confirm this, but during the video, we and there was no sound on the video. There was only footage from the surveillance cameras, I guess, in the shopping mall. And people were reacting before the shopping mall gets hit. We suspected that maybe that was air raid sirens. And I have been told on Twitter by a Substacker who writes about such things that there was a military target just across the railroad from the shopping mall, and there were two rockets. People were reacting to the first one hitting the military target across the railroad, and then they ran, and the shopping mall was hit. So, you know, I guess there is an argument that they were targeting a military target, and then, you know, and listen, there is no such thing as smart bombs or targeting, yeah, you know, precision targeting. When you blow up things, you're going to kill civilians. When you invade things, when you blow up things, you're going to kill civilians. This is, it does not matter whether it is your primary, your primary objective or not. Every single military person knows, and every political person in a position to order the military to do this knows that striking military targets with bombs, more than likely, even if it's one strike, almost guarantee the killing and striking of civilians and civilian targets. That's just, you cannot have one without the other. And pretending otherwise is a joke. And so these type of things were inevitable. And but just wanted to make a slight correction on that.
And not an overcorrection, because it's worth thinking about like how you would react to if America was using the same sort of justification. Oh, this was across the street from a justifiable target. It's like, that's true, but we shouldn't be invading this country and bombing them anyway.
Without we do use that justification all the time with drone strikes.
All the time. Got a couple of words from our sponsors today. Products that we use all. This one is I'm happy to talk about. A guest of ours on this program many, many times for many, many years now, Eddie Glaude, professor at Princeton, has a new podcast. There will always be something distinct about our present day, yet history haunts us. American democracy is at a crossroads, and we have to decide who we really are as a nation. History is Us, an important six-part documentary podcast series hosted by award-winning Princeton University professor Dr. Eddie Glaude, journeys back to face the truths about race at the heart of the American story. From the aftermath of the Civil War, the mid-20th century struggle for freedom, the election of Barack Obama, and the current-day racial reckoning, History is Us ask questions about who we are as a nation, what race might reveal about our current crisis, and where we go from here. Through the voices of distinguished historians and scholars, this limited series gives listeners the background and education to understand how we got here and how we can all use history to clarify the choices before us. Listen to History is Us, a presentation of Shining City Audio, C13 Originals, and John Meacham Studio, available now wherever you listen to your podcasts. Also, one out of three Americans report being sleep deprived, and their sheets could be the problem. I know my sheets now help. because Cozy Earth provides the softest and most luxurious, and for me, the most important thing, well, I like the feel of the sheets too, but the best temperature regulating sheets out there. I sleep hot, folks, and then I don't sleep. But Cozy Earth has been featured in Oprah's most favorite things listed 4 years in a row. They're made from super soft viscose, which is like, I don't know, it's basically thread, but it's not technically thread because it's from bamboo. Cozy Earth sheets breathe so you sleep at the perfect temperature all year round. With thousands of five-star reviews, it's no wonder Cozy Earth sheets have become the bedding of choice for interior designers and celebrities. Cozy Earth even offers a 100-night sleep trial. It means you have 100 nights to sleep on it. You can wash it. You try it out. I mean, that's over 3 months. If you're not completely in love, just send it back for a full refund. And there's a 10-year warranty. Cozy Earth sheets come in 4 new colors. Folks, check it out. We've had we've supported the sheets in the past. But these... well, first of all, I think these are going to last forever for me.
Yeah. I have the comforter. I told you that, right?
Yes. And
or the duvet, I should say.
The duvet. And I'm starting to get into the market for a duvet now, too, because they only last so long, the terms of dirty.
But this one seems like it's going to last a while. It's very soft.
But it's the temperature regulating that has been amazing, yeah. Particularly in this season, but even in the winter. I can't sleep hot, folks. Cozy Earth sheets help regulate my temperature. That sounds weird. For a limited time, save 35% on Cozy Earth bedding. Go to CozyEarth.com/majority. Enter my special promo code MAJORITY at checkout. Save 35% now. That's CozyEarth.com/majority. Be sure to enter MAJORITY at checkout for 35% off. 35% off. That's a big discount.
Yeah.
Folks, speaking of buying things at online stores, do you run a business? You want to start one? Supercharge your knowledge, your sales, and your success with Shopify. It is the all-in-one turnkey commerce platform to start, run, and grow your business. Shopify gives entrepreneurs the resources that apparently were once reserved for big business. I don't know. You get it. If you're an upstart, if you're a startup, if you're an established business, if you're a podcast that just needs a merch store, speaking from experience, you can sell everywhere, synchronize your online and in-person sales, and effortlessly stay informed. Shopify powers millions of businesses from first sale to full scale. You can reach customers online and across social networks with an ever-growing suite of channel integrations and apps, including Facebook, Instagram, you want to put it on TikTok, Pinterest, doesn't matter, all of it. Plus, you gain insights as you grow with detailed reporting of conversion rates, profit margins, and beyond. It's more than a store. Shopify grows with you. This is possibility powered by Shopify. We don't even use like a fraction of the power that Shopify provides for full-on businesses. But I have to say, it has been incredibly easy for us to maintain our online store for our merch stuff. We still underutilize it, but it's super easy to use. And the idea of having data that you can both use when you sell, let's say, at a live show and online, combine those, get a sense of like which shirts are selling better than others and that type of stuff. Really helpful. Go to Shopify.com/majority, all lowercase, for a free 14-day trial. Get full access to Shopify's entire suite of features. Grow your business with Shopify today. Go to Shopify.com/majority right now. Shopify, Shopify.com/majority. Just head over there and check it out and see what you can do. It's worth just checking it out. Okay. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Peter Shamshiri, co-host of the 5-4 podcast and contributor to the Balls and Strikes column. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. I want to welcome to the program Peter Shamshiri. He is the co-host of the 5-4 podcast, contributor to Balls and Strikes, put out by Demand Justice. Peter, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I was at a July 4th barbecue yesterday, and my buddy says, hey, you should listen to the 5-4 podcast because they're pretty good. And I said, well, actually, we got one of the co-hosts on tomorrow. So it made me seem really in the know. I appreciate your coming. Let's talk about the EPA, the West Virginia versus EPA case. And in fact, on some level, we could also, I guess tie in Becerra, the Becerra cases that came down a couple of weeks ago, because when we talk about the EPA West Virginia case, we are talking about maybe the end of the beginning of the unwinding of the administrative state in this country, and taking us back to something akin to the Lochner era. Let's get a little bit remedial with this case. It is about specifically a paragraph of the Clean Air Act and whether the EPA has the ability to control essentially the functioning of power plants. What does the act say? And then what did the EPA do that the court found was beyond their mandate or power?
Right. So the Clean Air Act says that the EPA has kind of broad authority to implement a system of emission reduction. And what this dispute is about is this Obama administration rule proposal called the Clean Power Plan, which sought to implement what's called generation shifting, which is just a way to have states distribute power in a way that diverts power away from high emission plants and towards low emission plants, wind farms, anything greener. It gets immediately stayed, so it was never actually in effect.
Nail this down. So it's basically just saying our system that we're developing is you're going to favor on the grid the ones that are less emissions. You're going to advantage them in the marketplace, as it were, so that we use all the renewable power first and the ones that don't have emissions. I mean, that seems pretty reasonable. And I mean, I'm not, I'm not an expert in this, but that seems pretty like not revolutionary. It's almost like the most basic first step that you would take.
Right. And I mean, that was the position that the EPA took here, essentially, that this is fairly standard. What ended up happening was that in 2019, the Trump administration proposes their own rule. And in the process, they say, we don't actually think that the EPA has the power to enact the Clean Power Plan that Obama proposed. And the reason they give is essentially they say that's a industry-wide regulation. It regulates across this industry. And the EPA's authority is limited to individual facilities, things like carbon scrubbing, et cetera, that you could implement at a single facility. And they don't have a real hook for that within the statute itself. They just sort of took the position that that's a reasonable reading of the EPA's power. And that rule gets challenged in the D.C. Circuit of Appeals. The D.C. Circuit sides with the Obama administration rule, and it goes up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court essentially just sides with the Trump administration.
And so the Supreme Court is basically agreeing with the idea that the EPA are supposed to be cops as opposed to making like any type of policy associated with an industry. That just seems bizarre and rather untraditional in the context of the way that the EPA has functioned for 50 years.
Yeah, I think that it sort of is the extension of a philosophy that the Roberts Court has been building out over the past several years, where they sort of eyeball a given agency and they say, well, what does it seem like the scope of their power should be? And are they acting outside of it? So last year, we saw this happen in the eviction moratorium case, where the CDC had implemented an eviction moratorium, originally under Trump. And that gets challenged. And the court sort of says, you know, the CDC is not the agency to be regulating the country's housing market, right? And here, they're sort of taking that logic a little farther and saying the EPA should not be regulating the energy industry broadly, right? That's outside of their prerogative. It's essentially too big in its scope. I wish that I could tell you that they had a really good reason for doing that, but they truly don't. You know, the language that Roberts used was that it raised an eyebrow that the EPA could do this. And that was really what the opinion hinges on.
I mean, I to be fair, I'm sure while you were talking, I raised my eyebrows.
Yeah, that's factually correct. The preemptive nature of this is also interesting to me, or something I'm hoping you can flesh out, because the Trump administration repealed the parts of the Clean Power Plan that are under dispute here, if I'm not mistaken. And so this was just, Biden's probably going to want to do this too, so let's get ahead of it, which I found to be, you know, one of the obvious and the nakedness of the politicization of the court, or really the right wing activism of the court, that was laid bare there, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, this is something that Ascent brought up. It's something the EPA brought up. This case probably shouldn't have been heard. It's just moot. The regulation was never in effect. There's no plan to put into effect. In fact, all the standards that it set out have been met. All the metrics have been met. So even if you put it into effect, it would not impose any obligations on any existing companies or states. So it's sort of unclear why the court would ever hear it and decide it, other than to sort of preempt any possible Biden administration rules.
Well, all right, let's get a little bit more aggressive in addressing that question, because it really is clear why they would do this, right?
Fair enough.
It's clear why they're doing it, because they have a specific agenda which supersedes supersedes jurisprudence. They have an agenda, which is, we are going to dismantle the ability of agencies to do this. And this is dangling out there. And there is almost, there have been dozens, I could probably sit down and make a list of cases that have been dismissed because they're moot. There's nothing to resolve here, because there was no real action. There was no implications to this case whatsoever, except for when the Supreme Court decided to broaden this case to being about the EPA's authority, hypothetically speaking, as opposed to in this instance.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, that was the big concern, especially for climate activists going into this, that the court was going to sort of take this massive swipe at the administrative state and at the EPA in particular, because why else would they take the case, right? I think that we sort of averted the worst case scenario. A lot of people were afraid that they were going to say that the EPA couldn't regulate CO2, which would reverse a case from 2007, Massachusetts v. EPA. We didn't get that, but instead we got this sort of, the Roberts Court sort of giving itself a blank check here, through what you mentioned, the major questions doctrine, to sort of interfere with regulations that it doesn't like. And essentially, to take a step back and talk about what they're doing in the sort of scope of the last 40 years, we had this case, Chevron, in the 80s, that created this idea that courts need to defer to administrative agencies in how they interpret statutes, essentially in how they interpret the scope of their own power. And
this was incidentally also about the Clean Air Act, the Chevron case.
Right, that's right. And that was pretty much uncontested law for a very long time. You had little exceptions popping up here and there. In the year 2000, there was a case, FDA v. Brown and Williamson, where the court held that tobacco was not a drug, such that the FDA could regulate it. And in doing so, they mention this sort of what they don't characterize as a doctrine, but they say, you know, on issues of vast political and economic significance, we're not going to defer so much to these agencies. And we think that the regulation of tobacco is one of those issues. So that's sort of the first time you see it articulated so cleanly.
The major questions, the so-called major questions doctrine. And just to be clear, so they're saying at that time when that FDA case comes up, that tobacco, and it was just a coincidence, I'm sure, that there was a lot of the tobacco money went to the Republican Party and the Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Society, whatever. And they create this doctrine out of whole cloth. What did they cite? Did they, I mean, in developing this new doctrine, and look, the Chevron doctrine is either like you have one or two choices, right? It's either the courts have the expertise to make these assessments about, you know, what's the best way to achieve this broad goal that Congress has essentially delegated to an agency. Or the agency with the experts has the, I mean, there's really, I don't know what, there's no third choice when you have, when that question comes. And in 2000, the early 2000s with the FDA case, they come up with a third answer, which is, except for at times where we really think it's important to us. But how did they justify that?
Well, I won't say that it was made up out of whole cloth. It sort of pulled at various really tiny exceptions to Chevron deference and sort of pieced them together into something that was a little more coherent, or at least internally coherent. It had some sort of internal logic. You know, there were always situations where courts were a little less likely to defer, and the administrative agencies always had to act within this sort of like reasonable scope of the statute to some degree, right? It wasn't just unlimited power. So the court sort of took that and ran with it very far in one direction. But that said, it didn't catch on. You know, that wasn't something that was a common exception at all. In 2007, in Massachusetts v. EPA, there was a Scalia dissent where he said that it doesn't matter how important an issue is. We need to be deferring to administrative agencies on these issues. And that was a dissent that was joined by Roberts, Alito, and Thomas. The difference, of course, was that the EPA in question was the Bush administration EPA, and that's who they were hoping to defer to. But, you know, this isn't something that was, you know, a
that
long
raises
conservative
an
project.
Eyebrow. That really raises an eyebrow. I mean, was that dissent raised in the dissent of the three in this West Virginia EPA case?
I think that they did mention the Massachusetts v. EPA case. I don't recall if they called out the Scalia quote in particular. That was something that I was rereading the case and jumped out to me as just, you know, a full rebuttal of the major questions doctrine sitting into an opinion that Roberts himself signed off on. And of course, Roberts writes the majority in West Virginia v. EPA.
That seems super damning if they actually cared.
That's right. If they were concerned about consistency or anything else, I think that would be very damning.
And to be fair, that was a full 15 years ago.
That's right. Times have changed. You know, it's a whole different world.
All right. So they cite the major questions doctrine. This was also cited, if I'm not mistaken, in the OSHA case.
That's right.
Can you talk about, I mean, we talked about it a little bit, but the way that it was applied in the OSHA case seems stunning to me. And what, and was there an opportunity for that case to go to the Supreme Court?
The OSHA case did go to the Supreme Court, mandate case.
Right.
Yeah. So you have this sort of three cases that the court has taken in the span of a year. You have the eviction moratorium case, you have the OSHA vaccine mandate case, and then this. Each of them, I think, increasingly ridiculous. So you start off with saying the CDC can't regulate the housing market. And then you get to OSHA can't regulate vaccines because it's not tied enough to the workplace, and OSHA regulates the workplace. And that's sort of the logic that the court took there. And then you get here where they're saying, you know, the EPA can't regulate the energy industry. So it's pretty clear that what's happening is that they have sort of formed this carve out for regulations that they don't like. They get to say, well, this is a matter of vast political and economic significance, so we're going to step in. We're not going to defer to the agency, and we're going to scrutinize the regulation very harshly. It's pretty clear that that rule doesn't have any meaning, right? What does it mean for something to be an issue of vast political and economic significance? We're talking about a regulation that's not even in effect right now in the West Virginia v. EPA case. So how it can have those sorts of vast implications is sort of beyond me. This is just a way for them to, if they want to, step in and mess with regulations they don't like. I mean, that's really all there is to it. And I think trying to parse the logic too much, it doesn't really get you that far.
Right. All right. Well, in the OSHA case, did they just shadow dock it? Or did they actually argue it? I feel like they did. They just sort of let that that lower court ruling stand. But maybe I'm wrong on that. But
I thought that there was an opinion. It might have just been a dissent. And maybe you're right that it was a shadow docket case. I honestly can't recall. It came out in January. We can check it, but I can check it. But I'm not sure.
All right. So they've developed this. They've taken this very high profile EPA case that had absolutely no real world implications to develop a doctrine about refusing to let agencies do what they want when something has major real world implications. And so they've just used the EPA case to develop this doctrine, which is basically like a wild card, right? Essentially that they can pull out of their deck at any time when there's a regulation they don't like. Is there a larger sort of like, is there a larger strategy than we're just going to deploy this when we don't like? I mean, because I think, you know, and were we in a position to talk to people who are actually in agencies now, they would all say it has made us gun shy to do X, Y, or Z. Like there is an impact, a real world impact for all these agencies when they know we're not going to dedicate 6 months, 3 months, 18 months, 36 months, like 4 years to develop a regulation, which, you know, this is a regulation from pre-2016, when we know the Supreme Court is going to knock it down. This has that impact of like a chilling effect.
Yeah.
But is there from the court, from these five or six justices, do they have an internal sort of like, what's the next step going to be? Because they don't want, you know, if somebody gets hit by a bus tomorrow, I'll just leave it like that without, cheering on for something like that. But if two people, let's say, just hypothetically, two people get hit by a bus tomorrow and two people get appointed by Joe Biden, the major questions doctrine could theoretically go the other direction. Like, you guys aren't doing climate change enough at the EPA. There's a major question. We think you should be doubling whatever it is that you're doing. Do they have a strategy to sort of lock things in, or are they just counting on actuarial tables?
I don't think that they do. I think that their position and the position of the Republican interests that push these cases is that the administrative state benefits the left and the Democrats much more than it benefits them. And so anything that throws a wrench into the gears is going to hurt the left more. I think that that's their essential position. I also think that their project is, you know, pretty vast. We're talking about, like you referenced, a group of people who fairly explicitly want to pare back the government to the pre-New Deal era, right? To really wipe out this bureaucracy. And Roberts's disdain for like agency bureaucracies is palpable in the opinion. He basically talks about them like they're a bunch of sort of unelected pencil pushers, right? And
who else is unelected? Who else is unelected in that scenario?
That's all I can think of is that Spider-Man meme.
Like, yeah, right.
Going like this.
I mean, frankly, the agency rules, keep in mind, there's a public comment period. There's a, when rules are proposed by agencies, when regulations are proposed, there's a period where the public gets to review and comment on it, and the agencies take input. So considerably more democratic than the Supreme Court, to be clear.
And we should say there's also a mechanism to challenge those rules once they're adopted, as right. we can see.
Yeah, like online Twitter polls are more democratic than the Supreme Court.
What? So, so what's happening now? I mean, are there trade groups right now saying like, okay, the EPA's ability to do a system-wide, industry-wide regulation seems to be largely dead, right? They can say they can go after this firm or that firm for breaking a pre-existing regulation, I guess, but they cannot promulgate any new regulations like, hey, we this new chemical that you guys have come up with in whatever type of plants it is, you can't dump that into the river. They can't do that? Or is there a question as to whether they could do that now?
There's a question. I mean, I don't think, frankly, the majority opinion here is so mealy-mouthed that it's hard to know exactly what the implications are, other than you couldn't do something that looks very much like generation shifting. You couldn't do something that has these sort of very clear industry-wide implications. There are some folks within, some climate activists who think that the coal companies might have sort of kicked themselves a little bit here, and that some of the regulations that the Biden administration, for example, is now more likely to pass might be a little more cumbersome even, just despite being targeted to individual facilities. So it's sort of unclear that in and of itself, this is notably good for the coal industry, for example. There's a lot of sort of back and forth about that. I think that the uncertainty that it creates is the real problem, not just within the agencies, but within Congress, right? I mean, if we're envisioning a world where we have votes for a Green New Deal, right, whatever that utopia might look like, Congress now has to concern themselves with exactly how they delegate authority to the EPA and whoever else, knowing that the Supreme Court is going to be eyeballing it very closely.
Could the FDA, for instance, at this point say, you can't have a factory farm with more than X number of livestock, annually, because we need to cut down on a disease that's running rampant, let's say, amongst livestock, and it has a propensity to promulgate more in livestock, in factory farms that have X number of livestock. So we're gonna change that as a blanket wide rule because they're charged with keeping our food supply safe. Could that be challenged? In the same way, or is this just like
this would be? I mean, this case would be limited to the Clean Air Act, at least theoretically. So I would think that the implications, at least the immediate implications for the FDA, for example, are pretty minimal. Other than the sort of the specter of the Supreme Court looming over them if they decide to get creative with their regulations.
But couldn't, let's say, the Fifth Circuit? If the FDA was to do that, like the Fifth Circuit picks it up, there's 13 circuit courts. Some are dominated by Republican appointees. Some are not. That's the best I think you can say for a lot of these. And they could just simply rule on it, and the Supreme Court would just be like, well, it's consistent with our major questions doctrine. We're not worried about that, right? I mean, that seems to be like, I mean, we're already seeing the abortion case. The Dobbs case was cited in an Alabama case, in my understanding, about trans rights.
Right.
And so this stuff, and specifically the part about it being traditional in the country, these Federalist Society jurists, these Republican appointees, are going to comb through this and just pull whatever they want. And the chances of them offending the five or six on the Supreme Court enough for certiorari to be granted seems minimal, right? Because you need four, right, to grant cert. And statistically speaking, the idea of like the three so-called liberals and one conservative justice, like it's not happening.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, in terms of where they go next, you look at agencies like the EEOC, like OSHA, like the CFPB, the Consumer Protection Bureau. You have all these obvious targets, and it's pretty clear that Republican and conservative activists, legal activists, are parsing through laws and regulations that they don't like, looking for angles. It worked here. It worked here when it didn't make a lot of sense, right? Where you had the Clean Air Act giving really broad authority to the EPA and the court saying, well, yeah, you know, it looks like broad authority, but it just doesn't make a lot of sense to us personally. And if that's what they're willing to say, then it seems like basically any agency that takes an action that conservatives don't like is at risk. And you run it up to the Fifth Circuit or the Sixth Circuit or whoever else is going to be friendly. Maybe they grant cert. It's not even that big of a risk that they grant cert, frankly, because you can win and take another step forward. I think that the most likely outcome here is that you have these groups like the Republican Attorneys General, I forget exactly what they're called, but this group of Republican Attorneys General, they sort of coordinate and bring these cases. They're probably looking for their next case right now.
Is there a next step? In other words, like we have the major questions doctrine. Does that take them to a more formal non-delegation doctrine where, I mean, this feels like it's a midterm step, right? It's saying Congress can't delegate decisions that are this big. What do we mean by big? Well, we know it when we see it, that type of thing. But could they be forming a doctrine that just basically says Congress can't delegate anything that has any type of, you know, the non-significant delegation doctrine? And the way that we measure that is, does it have more than a $3 million impact in any situation? Right. Could they be building towards something like that? Do you see any like hints at that?
Well, that's what Neil Gorsuch has been arguing for fairly explicitly. The return of non-delegation, which really pre-New Deal was sort of the ruling doctrine that Congress just can't really delegate a lot of authority to administrative agencies. And where exactly that lands right now with modern conservatives is unclear. But Neil Gorsuch has been taking the position that, and he wrote a concurrence in this case, basically saying, in this case, he said, this is basically close enough. This is functionally non-delegation, so I'm pretty happy with this. But I believe that he was sort of putting down his flag saying, there's a little more to this. And it's possible that you could get Gorsuch and maybe someone like Thomas, at least initially, on board for a broader non-delegation doctrine. Do they have five votes? I don't know, but they have enough that it's concerning.
Let's turn to the other really concerning thing. And there'll be more, right? Like, we don't even know what cases they're going to be accepting next year. Although we know that they just recently granted cert to a North Carolina redistricting case. And this has to do with the independent state legislature theory. What is this theory? And do we just like flash images of John Eastman and Rudy Giuliani on the screen to explain?
Yeah. So the Constitution grants state legislatures authority to structure their own elections, right? And the way what this theory does, and this is something that was really brought to prominence in Bush v. Gore as the primary argument of the Bush campaign, although not what the court ended up going with. This is essentially saying what that means is that the legislature can do whatever it wants, And not only that, but because the Constitution says the legislature specifically, there's no judicial review from state Supreme Courts, essentially giving complete free rein to state legislatures and the only review being the federal Supreme Court. So, I mean, the implications of that are essentially that, you know, in every state controlled by Republicans, controlled by fringe Republicans, there's potential that they do what they couldn't do in 2020, rally the troops, pass their own slate of electors, and there is simply nothing you could do about it other than appeal to the Supreme Court.
The state, for instance, could even, I mean, they could do that after the results of the election. Theoretically, according to this independent state legislature theory, they could vote for Democrats to win. They need 2/3 majority in votes. I mean, they, right? I mean, like that would, everybody would be like, hey, wait a second. That's crazy. But
When you take it to its extremes, that's the sort of thing you're looking at, right? There's nothing specific in the Constitution that would prevent that per se. Historically, courts have said, well, you know, you're making all these, there's no right to vote per se in the Constitution, but there's all these sort of references to it in the Reconstruction amendments, and states act as if there is a right to vote. And so courts have said, look, if you're sort of saying that there's an election, then you need to afford people the ability to vote and participate. But that's all sort of court-made doctrine. That's something that the Supreme Court could pare back pretty aggressively if they wanted to.
But isn't there also, like, state constitutions that seem to be, if a state court has no jurisdiction over how a state legislature operates federal elections, then it seems that the state constitution is also inoperable, because maybe you could enter it as evidence, I guess, if you're challenging the state court, the state legislature in the federal Supreme Court, but it's not in any way binding. It just seems to be a recommendation.
That's right. It would make state constitutions that guarantee the right to vote or whatever else functionally null. The state legislature can do what they want. And the Supreme Court would say, well, they're allowed to do what they want under the federal constitution. So state constitutions are not at play.
So you said that the first time that this sort of independent state legislature theory was tendered, I guess, in a most prominent way, was the Bush brief in Bush v. Gore. Am I wrong in remembering that John Roberts and Kavanaugh were, at the very least, young lawyers working for Bush at that time?
I don't know that Roberts was. Kavanaugh was, absolutely. You might be right about Roberts, but I'm not sure. Kavanaugh was a lawyer for Bush. He worked for the campaign on the legal team.
So we get a sense of maybe where he's at on this, right?
Yeah, I think it it does. It takes out a potential swing vote and moves him pretty firmly into one category. You know, if he was the one helping them research this theory, then it's hard to believe that he would back way off it now.
Is there and I guess I'm looking at this just Coney Barrett, I think, too. I think John Roberts worked there as well, and maybe Coney Roberts did.
Coney Barrett.
Coney Barrett, sorry. Yeah. That's not terribly comforting. Is it possible, Peter, that they would look at this and go, like, we've been wanting to knock this down ever since we introduced it 20 years ago, and we're taking this case because this is something that we really want to knock down?
I think it's possible. It's not something I would bank on too much. I mean, you have Thomas, who essentially bought the argument in 2000. So I think he will buy it again now. You have Gorsuch, who also seems like the kind of guy to the kind of jurisprudential purist, so to speak, to who might buy into it. Is it possible that someone like Kavanaugh and Coney Barrett looked at it and said this is a good chance to sort of take it on. Yeah, I guess it's possible. I'm not in the optimistic spirit when it comes to voting rights cases with the Supreme Court. So I wouldn't get hopeful.
Right. And it would be a little bit disturbing. I mean, the timing is also a little problematic, unless you're knocking it down, I guess, going forward.
Yeah. I mean, the timing is very concerning. And I mean, frankly, the cert grant on something this fringe, something that people really thought was, relegated almost entirely to right-wing cranks. I think it's just a reminder of where the court is right now. And I think that it's very possible that we're all wrong and they're just going to say, hey, no, you know, that's a silly theory. Get it. Please stop. Please bring us something a little more plausible. But it's hard to see look at their voting rights cases and think that they don't have some sympathy for this. They're very sympathetic towards the power of states in these cases.
Are there any other cases that you are aware of that are coming in front of the Supreme Court that we should begin to worry about now?
The affirmative action case is coming up will almost certainly be the end of affirmative action from state schools especially, but possible. We'll see. But how far they go. But there's almost no way there's five votes to uphold affirmative action right now. I would actually say you shouldn't worry about it. It's basically a done deal. You have an ICWA case, Indian Child Welfare Act, really horrifying, potentially horrifying case. ICWA is a law that was designed to protect Native American children from being adopted as readily as they were in the mid-century. There was a point, I think, in the 60s or 70s where something like a third of all Native children in this country were being adopted. And it was very clear that that was due to a concerted effort to sort of break up Native homes. ICWA is passed to address that. The court has been sort of paring it back in various ways over the past half decade or so, and there's a good chance it gets struck down next term.
And then, you know, and then it's off to the races. There's got to be a lot of Federalist Society people who are just teeing up cases and looking for plaintiffs all over across the country.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see what they do with 14th Amendment cases in the wake of Dobbs, if they want to go full speed, if they want to sort of pump the brakes just a little bit and see how this goes. But certainly someone is going to bring a gay marriage case up in the Fifth Circuit. Someone could challenge Lawrence v. Texas up in the Fifth Circuit, right? It's hard to see how that doesn't happen. So at the very least, I think we'll be sweating some cert petitions.
Well, Thomas was, I think it was Thomas, right? It was essentially signaling, go after Obergefell, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I got it. They're giving these state legislatures a roadmap to for what they are willing to take up and overturn, essentially.
Absolutely. I mean, the Thomas concurrence in Dobbs is sort of a classic, putting your flag down and saying, bring me some cases. You know, I'm interested. No one else, really seems to sign on to it, but it's hard to believe that you don't at least have Alito's vote, right? And you don't have, Coney Barrett's vote, right? Maybe someone can squeak out Gorsuch on some equal protection argument for some of this stuff. But I mean, it's hard to see how we survive 2 years without a very serious challenge to Obergefell.
Is the scenario of the Fifth Circuit takes a case that chips away at Obergefell or basically, more or less reverses it, and they don't grant it cert right away? Like, in other words, that we have, what is it, five states that are covered by the Fifth Circuit? Your marriages are nullified, or maybe they're grandfathered in, but there can't be any new ones. I mean, some weird thing like that in those states. And we start to have a sort of like, this is a marriage equality free zone where you just, if you're gay, you don't have the same rights as you would if you cross state lines in other parts of the country. I mean, it seems to me conceivable that we're going to have on a bunch of these for a while, we could have these sort of like different zones in the country where the fundamental rights are explicitly different. I mean, I feel like we had that on some level with abortion for the past couple of years, where there were some states where you effectively had no right to an abortion. But this would be explicit.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at what happened with abortion in Texas with SB 8, I mean, the court was willing to turn a blind eye to an unbelievable amount of shenanigans happening in the lower courts that effectively made Roe null and void for 10 months before it was actually struck down. When you look at that, it's hard not to imagine a world where there are localized attacks on marriage equality, on you know, the right to consensual sex of whatever type you feel like having. It feels to me like there's a real plausible future where you chop the country up a little bit into zones where there are certain rights that are protected and zones where they're not. And the Supreme Court is at least for a bit just looking the other way.
And I was going to ask you like sort of along that same lines, because I'm just trying to give people a sense of like how this is going to go down over the next, like, I don't know, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 15 years. Trap laws were targeted regulation of abortion providers, if I'm not mistaken, but trap laws were basically these laws that states would pass to sort of like shimmy around the constitutional right for abortion, right? Like abortion's legal, but we only allow abortion providers to provide that service if they have vaulted ceilings that are 25 feet high and with a rotunda, essentially. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but that's basically what it was. We're going to pass regulations that are impossible to meet. And the court at one point found, like, you can't do that. It's obvious. And then they started to relax on it. Do you think we're going to see that for things like birth control and like a whole host of individual rights that we have had, voting rights, maybe, on and on, allowing the states to inhibit in a practical level things that we presume are rights? And I feel like it's going to dovetail in with sort of like religious freedom stuff.
Yeah. That's what I was going to, first of all, they already do it with voting rights, right? I mean, they might not do it anywhere more than they do with voting rights, just sort of allow for these logistical impediments without sort of striking down the right, quote unquote. But I think that when it comes to gay marriage, birth control, et cetera, what you're really likely to see is the expansion of these religious exceptions where someone does not have to sell you birth control. Someone does not have to provide you with a marriage certificate, right? What was her name? Kim Davis over in Kentucky or wherever.
Kentucky.
You're already seeing this. I think there have been some trending stories about people being denied birth control just at like Walgreens by clerks who were saying, you know, I don't really want to give you condoms. I don't want to sell you this.
This happened during the Bush administration as well, actually, big time.
Right. I mean, and I think that this court has been extremely sympathetic to religious objections of all types. So if they want to sort of stop short of attacking the constitutional right in full, I think that's likely where they go. They sort of create a world where logistically, not only is it difficult, say, to access birth control, but if you do, someone can deny it right to your face and say that they have a religious objection, leading to this sort of another type of chilling effect where people sort of find it potentially humiliating just to go buy condoms or whatever, because someone can say, you know, I don't agree with your lifestyle choice right to your face, right in line at CVS.
Although condoms, I think, are less likely to be targeted because those are at the male discretion for the most part, since men cis men use condoms. I feel like they're definitely going to be targeting. They already are Plan B, IUDs, eventually probably the pill as well.
Yeah, I only used condoms because that was sort of one of those viral stories that just happened over the past weekend where someone brought it up.
Yeah.
But I think that there's probably going to be an argument about what is or is not an abortion, right? Is Plan B abortive? Mm. Now, scientists and doctors will say pretty clearly no. But the question of what's an abortion exactly could be a gray area if you are a little bit intellectually flexible, shall I say, which I think the courts are quite clearly willing to be.
Well, along those lines, and I appreciate you going a little long with us on this, but there's a lot of questions that come from Dobbs. We have 43,000 ectopic pregnancies a year. To deal with those ectopic pregnancies, you need to basically perform an abortion. To evacuate miscarriages, you need to often perform, the actions of an abortion. You know, the implications of it aren't the same, but the actions are the same. And so you've got all these doctors who are, their actions to an outside observer, and really by any mechanism in which you can show any evidence, appear to be an abortion. It involves the life of the mother. How will this, will each state come up with their mechanism to say, to provide immunity for a doctor in that instance? I mean, it seems to me we are on the cusp of, in addition to stories like a 10-year-old having to leave Ohio to go to Indiana because she's been raped, and it was 6 weeks and 19 days, and she's got to go to Indiana to get an abortion. That option may not exist, once Indiana gets rolling and she has to go to another state. And I want to talk about crossing state lines in a minute. But the other sort of mess of stories we're going to get are women dying because doctors are afraid to perform a medical treatment on a woman because it's going to be perceived as an abortion by the state. And they can't quantify how much her life is in danger in a way to satisfy the criminal and civil penalties that they could face in performing that abortion.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's not only inevitable, but probably happening now to a degree that we just don't yet understand. I think you sort of have states where there's going to be two regimes. One is that the really brutal regimes that just don't really create exceptions, maybe outside life of the mother. And then regimes that are a little more flexible. But even then, if for a doctor performing the abortion, you have to be prepared to explain yourself and potentially, if you don't do it correctly, go to prison, right? And there's a question of how over time you even find these doctors if you're a pregnant person looking for one, right? It seems there are plenty of ectopic pregnancies, for example, in the United States, but could you be a doctor that consistently practices them and make yourself available to people who need them, right? Communicate that you're ready to perform them, et cetera. I mean, even before Dobbs, there were states that only had a couple of clinics willing to perform abortions. So now you're going to see the number dwindle down surely there will be states with zero. There will be more states with just a handful. I don't think there's any way around it. It's just going to be harrowing and awful for anyone seeking an abortion for any reason in the coming years. There's just sort of no way around it. If you're in a state that has that protects the right and has sort of widely available doctors, then you might be okay. But everyone else is in a brutal situation.
What about crossing state lines? Do states have the ability to create civil or criminal liability for women or providers, for that matter, who cross state lines to perform or receive an abortion?
So states are certainly trying. Missouri passed a law. I think that the by far the most likely outcome, and you can see this in the Kavanaugh concurrence where he says it explicitly, is that the court would say that people have a right to interstate travel. You have a right to travel between states for whatever reasonable purpose, and the states cannot inhibit that. So I'm cautiously optimistic here because Kavanaugh basically said this explicitly. He said in his concurrence that interstate travel is a protected right, so states that try to do that, it won't fly with me.
Well, first off, where does it say that in the Constitution?
It's an implied right. Yeah.
But with that said, travel in between states can be illegal. What about I run a nonprofit that charters planes and or that funds interstate travel explicitly for women to get abortions? Could I be civilly charged under, a Texas law because my plane or whatever it is, my car or whatever it is, lands in Texas, picks up the woman, takes her to the free state of Colorado or whatever it is, and she gets an abortion there. Can I be criminally or civilly liable in that instance?
I think you're definitely getting into a grayer area. I think that you would probably succeed by saying that this is sort of hand in hand with the right to interstate travel. You can't punish me for example, for aiding and abetting if what the other person is doing is not a crime, right? So it depends exactly what angle the states try there. I would think that they'd be okay, at least, sort of legally okay. I shouldn't say that they'd be okay because I think you're still going to get harangued by state officials, by cops, by people who are trying to enforce a law, no matter how unconstitutional Brett Kavanaugh thinks it is. But I would think that you're still protected by that right to interstate travel in those cases.
We'll see when they start requiring the airplanes to have like 26-foot vaulted ceilings to transport abortion patients. All right. So lastly, let me ask you this. I think there's a very good chance. I don't know how to quantify that, but I think there is an over 40% chance, all things considered, that by this time in 2025, we're going to have a federal ban on abortion. What happens if I'm in New York State, there's a federal ban on abortion, and my state constitution guarantees me a right to abortion? Are we looking at like the marijuana situation that we've had in this country, like in the early days of states legalizing marijuana? I mean, what is that? How does that shake out?
I think that it would be a supremacy clause issue where the Republican position would be that the federal legislation controls and that it overrides any pre-existing state laws, including in state constitutions. I would think that the court sides with them on that as well. That seems most likely. So my guess is that it's not quite like the marijuana situation, but a much more aggressive enforcement regime from the federal level. That's what I would expect.
I mean, legally, it's a similar situation, but there is. If they pass a ban, it's a bunch of fanatics, and the Attorney General, Steve Bannon, is going to be like, we're going to make an example of, some people in Brooklyn. And we're gonna nail these people.
Absolutely, and it also depends on exactly what authority Congress calls upon to pass the law. Are they using the Commerce Clause? Are they using the 14th Amendment or something else? How creative do they get there? We would sort of need to see the law to make real strong predictions. I would imagine that it would be a nightmare, but that's as far as I'll go.
Peter Shamshiri, let me ask you one final question. You bummed about naming your podcast 5-4?
The amount of flack we get for it now. I always tell people it's symbolic. It's symbolic of the partisan divide, but that hasn't stopped them from berating us on Twitter. and telling us that we need to change the name of our podcast.
I would just slowly drop in an asterisk. And then I think that's the way you get around that. Peter Shamsheri, the podcast of the 5-4 podcast. And, of course, folks, check out the Balls and Strikes column at Demand Justice, an organization that is really pushing the among the other things, pushing the Biden administration to appoint more judges. We'll talk more about that as the show progresses. But, Peter, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, folks, going to head into the fun half of the program, which, you know, these days, not necessarily super, super fun, but we'll have moments. We got some light moments to bring up. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the free show, free of commercials. You also get access to the fun half. Become a member today. I don't know what to tell you. This is, I'm going to try and maintain some, optimism. But the Supreme Court, situation that we are now in, it is about as bad as any of our predictions were, and despite the fact that been seeing this sort of like slow motion train wreck coming for 6 years in many respects. I mean, frankly, in terms of my obsessive nature, it has been 22. The Bush v. Gore decision, in my mind, was a harbinger. And I'm still sitting around trying to figure out, like, you know, what the answer is. I mean, what an answer is. And Chi-Town Lefty just wrote, welcome to the solemn half. I mean, you know, like.
Yeah.
It's, I.
At the very least, like, the Biden administration has to, like, act with urgency on the abortion decision and do everything he can.
It's definitely political responses that we can take to mitigate. You know, there's two realms, right? There's the sort of like material implications of these rulings, and then there's the political implications of these rulings. The material implications of these rulings cannot really be handled at this point by elected officials.
Yeah.
I mean, they can't, you know, marginally maybe, but the material implications of this, and we're going to get into it as the weeks come up. I know that like there's a, you know, and I feel this pressure, too, to have activists on and to have people who are being subjected to the implications of these things on the program. And there's going to be time for that.
Support abortion funds.
Yes. And but much of the mitigation on the material front, like I said, there's some that elected politicians can do, but not much. Much of the material implications on, are going to have to come from organizing and, you know, mutual aid and, nonprofit groups, I guess, on some level.
But with the dismantling of the administrative state and the EPA rulings and what that probably indicates for future environmental regulations as our planet nears towards a irreparable chain reaction where climate will become inhospitable for a lot of people. That part is difficult to.
That is not, there's no mutual aid situation there.
Yeah.
There, you can be mitigated by states. You know, California and New York then become, you know, hugely important because they can change the direction of some industries. Not all. But you could change, you know, California can change the direction of the car industry, for instance, because there's so many cars. It's such a huge economy, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of that stuff's going to be piecemeal. But with all that said, on the political front, it is crucial that Democrats, the Democratic leadership, do everything they can to get as much mitigation out of the political side of things. And so far, they are piss poor at it. We'll talk more about this in the fun half. But the point being, support the show. give me a super chat. Like,
yeah. And right.
Super chat right now. Poggers.
Hype train level a million.
Hype train level five. Over the next, you know, couple of weeks.
Hype train level train taking you to another state so you can get your abortion.
Yeah. Right? McCarty has just said the Lochner era ran 40 years. I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
Yeah, for patrons this weekend, we released half of our conversation with Lee Phillips about Lee makes a case for nuclear energy. It's a little bit of a controversial one. Patreon.com just left reckoning Lee Phillips' case for nuclear energy and why the left shouldn't turn its back on it.
I'm going to check that out. Spicy.
I'm interested.
646-257-3920 is the number if you want to call this program. See you in the fun. Oh, don't forget justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Great coffee. Great coffee. Also, you can IM the show by picking up the app at majorityapp.com. It is free if you have an iPhone or an Android phone.
Yeah.
If you have some Linux-based phone, I don't know that we can help you. So.
Sorry if you have a Nokia. But you can watch the show on YouTube.
What do you mean?
I mean, if you have a Linux-based phone, you could probably
help
yourself.
Aren't Nokias not Androids, right?
Yeah, they are. Of course they are.
No, I thought those were like flip phones.
What? God. Oh, the old ones? Well, maybe.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it is.
If you don't have a smartphone, then you can't have apps.
Okay, all right. Well, I don't know anything about phones.
You can call into the line, though, and just listen to it that way.
That's right. See you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt!
Yo. Fun. What is up, everyone? Fun.
Nomi Keen.
You did it! Fun. Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon. Fun.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this,
7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is it?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm gonna go for a walk.
Ooh, libertarians.
They're so stupid though. Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So, what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I wanna say.
857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
You call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all, my favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, Sundial Guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.